This is a Healing House broadcasting series, reading on a history of Cambodia. Fourth edition by David Chandler. Excerpt from David Chandler. A History of Cambodia. Episode 2, Chapter 2. The Beginnings of Cambodian History. No one knows for certain how long people lived in Cambodia, where they came from, or what languages they spoke before writing was introduced, using an Indian-style alphabet, around the 3rd century BC. Carbon-14 dates from a cave at Long Spien in northwestern Cambodia. However, people who knew how to make pots lived in the cave as early as 4200 BC. Another cave near the ocean was inhabited about 1,000 years later. Presumably, the first Cambodians arrived long before either of these dates. Evidence of a more primitive, pebble-working culture has been found in the eastern parts of the country. Skulls and human bones found at Samrongsen, inhabited since around 1500 BC, suggest that these prehistoric Cambodians physically resembled Cambodians today. Whether the early people came originally from what is now China and India and from elsewhere in Southeast Asia is still debated by scholars, as are theories that waves of different peoples moved through the region in prehistoric times. But recent finds suggest that mainland Southeast Asia had a comparatively sophisticated culture in the prehistoric era. Some scholars even attribute the first cultivation of rice and the first bronze casting to the region. In any case, it is likely that by the beginning of the Christian era, the inhabitants of what is now Cambodia spoke languages related to present-day Cambodian or Khmer. Languages belonging to the Mon-Khmer family are found widely scattered over mainland Southeast Asia, as well as in some of the islands and parts of India. Modern Vietnamese, although heavily influenced by the Chinese, is a distant cousin. It is impossible to say when these languages split off from one another. Some linguists believe that the split took place several thousand years ago. Khmer, then, unlike the other national languages of mainland Southeast Asia, aside from Vietnamese, is not a newcomer to the area. This continuity is one of many that strikes students of Cambodia's past. What is interesting about the cave at Long Spien is not merely that it was inhabited, on and off, for so long. The most recent carbon-14 date from the cave is from the 9th century CE, but that the methods used to make pottery found at the earliest level and the patterns incised on them have remained unchanged for perhaps 6,000 years. The changelessness of Cambodian history was often singled out by the French, who saw themselves as introducing change and civilization to the region in the 19th and 20th centuries. Ironically, this theme was picked up by Pol Pot's revolutionary regime, which claimed that Cambodians were asleep or enslaved for 2,000 years. Both points of view ignore a great deal of evidence. Arguably, the revolution of the 1970s was the fifth major one that Cambodia has undergone since prehistoric times. But pre-revolutionary Cambodians were less contemptuous of tradition than Pol Pot was. "Do not choose a straight path," a Cambodian proverb tells us. And "do not reject a winding one. Choose the path your ancestors have trod." Part of this conservatism, perhaps, is characteristic of a subsistence-oriented society in which experimentation can lead to famine and in which techniques of getting enough to eat are passed from one generation to the next. We know very little about the daily lives of Cambodians in prehistoric times. We know that their diet, like that of Cambodians today, included a good deal of fish. It seems likely that their houses, from an early date, were raised above the ground and made accessible by means of ladders. Clothing was not especially important. Early Chinese accounts refer to the Cambodians as naked. After about 1000 BCE, they perhaps lived in fortified villages, often circular in form, similar to those inhabited by some tribal peoples in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. Sites of such villages have been excavated in eastern Cambodia. Like other early inhabitants of the region, the Cambodians had domesticated pigs and water buffalo fairly early. They grew varieties of rice and root crops by the so-called slash-and-burn method common throughout the tropics as well as in medieval Europe. These early people probably passed on many of their customs and beliefs to later inhabitants of the region. However, we cannot be sure of this. There are dangers of reading back into prehistoric and early Cambodia what we can see among so-called primitive tribes or 21st-century peasants. We cannot be sure that these modern customs have not changed over time. Hairstyles, for example, changed dramatically in Cambodia as recently as the early 18th century, and in the 1970s, they were changed again by the revolutionary regime. All the same, it is unlikely that certain elements of Cambodian life and thinking, especially in the countryside, have changed a great deal since Angkorean times, from the 9th to the mid-15th centuries, or even over the last few thousand years. These elements might include the village games played at the Lunar New Year, the association of ancestor spirits, Nak Ta, with stones, the calendar, and the soil, the belief in water spirits or dragons, the idea that tattoos protect the wearer, and the custom of chewing betel, to name a few. Indianization. However, the notion of changelessness dissolves when we discuss the revolutionary changes that suffused Cambodia at the beginning of the Christian era. This was the centuries-long phenomenon known as Indianization, whereby elements of Indian culture were absorbed or chosen by the Cambodian people in a process that lasted more than 1,000 years. No one knows precisely when the process began or how it worked at different times. All-inclusive theories about it advanced by French and Dutch scholars usually put too little emphasis on the element of local choice. A few writers, on the other hand, may have tended to exaggerate the importance of local elements. Generally, as George Coeds has remarked, scholars with training in Indian culture emphasize India's civilizing mission. At the same time, those trained in the social sciences stress the indigenous response. Historians must deal with both sides of the exchange. The process by which a culture change is complex. When and why did Indian cultural elements come to be preferred to local ones? Which ones were absorbed, revised, or rejected? In discussing Indianization, we encounter the categories that some anthropologists have called the great and others, the little traditions, the first connected with India, Sanskrit, the courts, and Hinduism, and the other with Cambodia, Khmer, villages, and folk religion. In the Cambodian case, these categories are not especially useful. We cannot play down the great tradition in Cambodian village life. Where does monastic Buddhism fit in, for example, or little tradition activities like ancestor worship and folk stories at the court? Village wisdom always penetrated the court, and princely values enshrined in Hindu epics and Buddhist legends or Jataka tales penetrated village life. Nowadays, urban and rural cultural traditions interact in Cambodia in a similar fashion. Nevertheless, the process of Indianization made Cambodia an Indian-seeming place. In the 19th century, for example, Cambodian peasants still wore recognizably Indian costumes. In many ways, they behaved more like Indians than like their closest neighbors, the Vietnamese. For example, Cambodians ate with spoons and fingers and carried goods on their heads. They wore turbans rather than straw hats and skirts rather than trousers. Musical instruments, jewelry, the alphabet, and manuscripts were also Indian in style. It is possible that Indians had introduced cattle raising in Cambodia at a relatively early date. It is unknown, to a great extent, in mainland Southeast Asia. Trade between prehistoric India and Cambodia probably began long before India itself was Sanskritized. In fact, as Paul Muse has suggested, Cambodia and southern India and what is now Bengal probably shared the culture of monsoon Asia, which emphasized the role played by ancestral, tutelary deities in the agricultural cycle. These were often located for ritual purposes in stones that naturally resembled phalluses or were carved to look like them. Sacrifices to the stones, it was thought, ensured the fertility of the soil. Cults like this were not confined to Asia, but it is useful to see, as Muse has, that an Indian traveler coming across them in Cambodia would recognize them as Indian cults honoring the god Shiva or one of his consorts. Similarly, a Cambodian visiting India or hearing about it would see some of his own cults and those that honored the Indian god. During the first 500 years or so of the current era, India provided Cambodia with a writing system, a pantheon, meters for poetry, a language, Sanskrit, to write it in, a vocabulary of social hierarchies, not the same as a caste system, Buddhism, the idea of universal kingship, and new ways of looking at politics, sociology, architecture, iconography, astronomy, and aesthetics. Without India, Angkor would never have been built, yet. Angkor was never an Indian city any more than medieval Paris was a Roman. 1. Indian influence in Cambodia was not imposed by colonization or by force. Indian troops never invaded Cambodia, and if individual Indians enjoyed high status, as they often did, it was partly by convincing local people that they deserved it. When Indians came, at first as adventurers, perhaps, or as traders, they were absorbed into the local population. Perhaps just as often, news from India came via Cambodian traders who had visited the subcontinent. Indianization never produced the identity crisis among Cambodians that Chinese colonization and cultural imperialism produced among the Vietnamese. Cambodia never resisted India, which was not, in any case, a unified state. Moreover, unlike Vietnam vis-a-vis Han China, Cambodia never looked to India after the 14th century or so for ideas, approval, or advice. Indianization gave a format and a language to elite Cambodian life, but it was not narrowly political. Moreover, the hierarchical arrangements that came to characterize the language and behavior of the Cambodian elite, although owing something to Indian models, never sprang from a recognizable caste system affecting Cambodian society as a whole. At the village level, caste considerations never took root. What resembled a caste system at the medieval Cambodian court, moreover, probably was little more than a set of ritual procedures that showed respect for Indian traditions. Another byproduct of Indianization in Cambodia is that Cambodian nationalism, unlike its Vietnamese counterpart, has not generally pictured itself as the product of a struggle against foreign invaders and advice. Instead, national identity was seen as the sum of social arrangements in effect inside Cambodia until recent times. Indianization and elements of life that may be traceable to India were merely components of the sum. The fact that they came from India, just as our Pali syllables so often come from Greece and Rome, was not considered a reason for alarm. Like many Southeast Asian countries, Cambodia has a legend that originates with the marriage of a foreigner and a dragon princess, or Nagi, whose father was the king of a waterlogged country. According to one version of the myth, a Brahmin named Kaundinya, armed with a magical bow, appeared one day off the shore of Cambodia. The dragon princess paddled out to meet him. Kaundinya shot an arrow into her boat, frightening the princess into marrying him. Before the marriage, Kaundinya gave her clothes to wear, and in exchange, her father, the Dragon King, enlarged the possessions of his son-in-law by drinking up the water that covered the country. He later built them capital and changed the name of the country to Cambodia. This myth is of Indian origin, as is the name Cambodia, and perhaps it describes some obscure confrontation that had occurred during the Aryanization of southern India rather than an event in Southeast Asia. But if it is useless as a fact, it offers us an interesting starting point for Cambodian history. In the myth, Cambodians see themselves as the offspring of a marriage between culture and nature. Kaundinya's acceptance by his father-in-law, who drains the kingdom for him, is crucial to his success. This idea would have been familiar to Cambodians, for until recently, a prospective bridegroom often had to gain his in-law's approval by living with them before his marriage. In the myth, the local people, i.e., the dragons, respect the Brahmin, and in his honor, give the kingdom an Indian name, which first appears in a Cambodian inscription in the 9th century CE. Later on, many Cambodian monarchs would trace their ancestry to this mythical pair, who represented, among other things, a marriage between the sun and the moon. To be a legitimate king, it seems, one had to be Cambodian and Indian at the same time. Fuanan. Chinese officials recorded the Kaundinya myth. Indeed, written sources for Cambodian history are almost entirely Chinese for the first few centuries of the Christian era. These are supplemented by archaeological findings, especially from the remains of an ancient trading city located near the modern Vietnamese village of Oceo in the Mekong Delta, excavated during World War II by an archaeological team supervised by Louis Malaret. Roman coins found at the site in Angkor Borei date from the 2nd and 3rd centuries, and some Indian artifacts, including seals and jewelry, can be dated to the same period. Malaret believed that the port declined in importance in the 4th century. However, no contemporary records about it have survived, and we do not know what its inhabitants called it. Because of its location and some of the artifacts found at the site, Mallaret concluded that the port was used by pilgrims and traders moving between India and China in the first centuries of the Christian era. The size of the city suggests that it played an important part in this trade, and its location was ideal for ships hugging the coast and turning the corner from or into the South China Sea. The city probably provided warehousing for goods in transit between India and China and was an outlet for products collected from the forested interior of Cambodia and Vietnam. Forest products and precious metals made up the bulk of Cambodia's export trade until the 20th century. This included gold, elephants, ivory, rhinoceros horn, kingfisher feathers, wild spices like cardamom, and forest products such as lacquer, hides, and aromatic wood. Plantation exports like rubber and pepper were developed in the colonial era. Rice exports, which made up the bulk of 20th century Cambodian foreign trade, were also of little use in early times, when nearly everyone in the region produced enough to feed themselves. The point to make about these high-value, low-bulk goods is that they were cultivated or caught by forest people rather than by the inhabitants of towns. Many of them probably traveled considerable distances before they reached OCEO, and so did the goods or coins that traders used to pay for them. Until very recently, many scholars believed that OCEO was the seaport for an important kingdom identified by Chinese sources as Funan and located by George Coeds, using linguistic evidence rather than archaeological findings, near the small hillock known as Ba Phnom in southeastern Cambodia, east of the Mekong. According to Coeds, the word Funan derives from the old Khmer word for mountain, Phnom, and he located the ritual center of the kingdom at Ba Phnom. A cult to Shiva as a mountain deity existed in Cambodia as early as the 5th century CE and may well have been enacted on Ba Phnom. An Indian traveler to China reported that it is the custom of the country to worship the celestial god Mahasvara Shiva. This deity regularly descends on Mtmotam, so that the climate is constantly mild and herbs and trees do not wither. Paul Wheatley has suggested that the cult originated in southern India and that the mountain was not Ba Phnom, but another hillock not far away, in what is now Vietnam. The evidence that either mountain was a cult site is stronger than the evidence that Funan was a major, unified kingdom, or that its political center was associated with either hill. What made the place important to the Chinese was that a principality dubbed Funan by the Chinese offered tribute to the Chinese emperor, on an irregular basis, between 253 and 519. Stone inscriptions in Sanskrit and Khmer from a century later are available for study. They do not provide evidence for a major kingdom. It is possible, nonetheless, that small chiefdoms in Cambodia occasionally banded together and called themselves a kingdom for the purposes of sending tributary goods to China, an ideal occasion for encouraging trade, or of seeking Chinese help against their neighbors. It is also possible that Funan was thought to be a major kingdom because the Chinese wanted it to be one. Later, French scholars were eager to find a predecessor for the more centralized kingdom of Angkor, which developed in northwestern Cambodia in the 9th century. Despite their usefulness in many ways, Chinese sources for this period present peculiar problems for the historian, as many of them uncritically repeat data from previous compilations as if they were still true. Nonetheless, Chinese descriptions are often as vivid as this one about Funan. The king's dwelling has a double terrace on it. Palisades take the place of walls in fortified places. The houses are covered with the leaves of a plant that grows on the edge of the sea. These leaves are 6 to 7 feet long and take the form of a fish. The king rides mounted on an elephant. His subjects are ugly and black, their hair is frizzy, they wear neither clothing nor shoes. For living, they cultivate the soil, they sow 1 year and reap for 3. These barbarians are not without their own history books. They even have archives for their texts. There is evidence that the major step during the Funan period toward the integration of the small, dry rice-growing and root-cultivating principalities, whose people worshipped Shiva, with hunting and gathering societies inland from OCEO was the introduction, perhaps as late as 500, of systematic irrigation. Drainage probably came earlier. We have seen in the Kondinya myth that drainage was attributed to the good offices of a dragon king, but the most important passage related to this innovation, and to Indianization, is Chinese, one which appears at first to be a garbled version of the original myth. Then a Brahmin named Kaundinya ruled the kingdom. A spirit announced to him that he would be called upon to govern Fuanan, so he traveled there, and the people of Fuanan came out to meet him and proclaimed him king. He changed the institutions to follow Indian models. He wanted his subjects to stop digging wells and to dig reservoirs in the future. Several dozen families could then unite and use one of these in common. 7th and 8th century inscriptions refer to rice fields adjacent to religious foundations that are suggestive of irrigated rice, and aerial photographs of the Mekong Delta show silted over canals, which may have been used for drainage as well as transport. If irrigation was widely used before the 9th century, it was not on an especially large scale and, with the exception of the 7th century agglomeration of Isanapra, now known as Sambor Prey Kuk, near Kampong Tom, the village was the most characteristic unit of pre-Angkorian Cambodia. Indeed, Isanapra probably consisted of villages grouped around a common ritual center, whose stone buildings have survived. Even after the introduction of wet rice technology, perhaps in the 4th or 5th century, the area under irrigation, which is to say, under the control of supra-village organizations, was never very great. Moreover, it seems likely that most villagers in the hinterland continued to grow dry rice and to cultivate roots, supplementing their diet by hunting and gathering, long after irrigation and wet rice cultivation had taken hold in comparatively Hinduized communities. People, rather than land per se, are needed to cultivate wet rice. Keeping in mind this fact, as well as the low density of the population in the entire area, always excepting Java, Bali, and the Red River Delta in Vietnam, it is easy to see why, throughout Southeast Asian history, overlordship and power were so often thought of and pursued in terms of controlling people rather than land. Population pressure, of course, probably impelled some Cambodian rulers, perhaps including Jayavarman II, to take control over new territory where the population could be deployed to grow rice. There were periods of Cambodian history, under Jayavarman VII in the 12th century, for example, when far-flung territorial control was an important part of a king's prestige. Nonetheless, control over territory per se, near forest in most cases, was rarely as important as controlling people. Indeed, the notion of alienable ownership of land, as distinct from land use, does not seem to have developed in pre-Angkorian Cambodia. Land left fallow for 3 years reverted to state control. The king, theoretically at least, was the lord of all the land in the kingdom, which meant that he could reward people with the right to use it. Many of the Cambodian language inscriptions from the Angkorian period, as we shall see, dealt with complicated disputes about access to land and labor resources. The record of inscriptions and, by inference, of architectural remains from the first 8 centuries of the Christian era fails to provide evidence of large-scale unified kingdoms on Cambodian soil, and aside from Angkor Borei, very little evidence of the development of urban centers. There seems to have been some continuity among members of the elite, traceable in part to their tendency to marry among themselves, as we learn from surviving inscriptions. At the same time, it seems likely that the territory we now call Cambodia, like much of the rest of early Southeast Asia, contained a collection of small states, each equipped with a court and an elite, and that these segments had entourages, or strengths, of people growing food for them who could also be called upon to fight. Presumably, these chiefdoms traded among themselves and raided each other, particularly for slaves. It also seems likely that each king, when undisturbed, or when disturbing others, thought of himself as a universal monarch, benefiting from Indian teachings, as well as a local chieftain, performing identifiable Cambodian tasks. Leadership was measured to a large extent by prowess, which was measured by success in battle, by the ability to attract a large following, and by demonstrated skill at performing religious rituals and providing protection. As J.D.M. Derrett has pointed out, protection, along with rainfall, is the sine qua non of peasant society. Protection from enemies, from rival overlords, from the forces of nature. In recognition of this necessity, overlords in the time of Fuanan and throughout Cambodian history often included in their reign names the suffix varman, originally armor, hence protection. The overlords themselves thought that they could not live without supernatural protection, and most of them sought this, in part, through their devotion to Shiva. Here they were assisted, for a time at least, by a group of Indian Brahmins, the so-called Pasiputa, who enjoyed a vogue in India and elsewhere in Southeast Asia around the 5th and 6th centuries. These wandering ascetics preached those personal devotions to Shiva were more rewarding than meticulous attention to Brahmanical rituals or to the law of destiny or karma. Technically, an overlord's devotion did not require the intercession of the Pasiputta, and some of them presumably did without it. In any case, these self-made Hindus were perceived, and saw themselves, as superior men, vehicles of Shiva, the god who ceaselessly descended onto a holy mountain. The transmission of Shiva's potency via the overlord and his ritual acts to the people and the soil was an important source of cohesiveness. In Cambodian society, it has also been a source of continuity. As late as 1877, human sacrifices to a consort of Shiva were conducted at Bapanam at the beginning of the agricultural year. Like those described in 5th century Chinese sources, these had the objective of transmitting fertility to the region and, like the Chinese rituals, they were sponsored by local officials. In the Phuanan era, Buddhism also flourished in Cambodia, and the Buddhist concept of merit, which still suffuses much Cambodian thinking about society, resembles, in some ways, the notions of prowess and salvation just discussed. In both schemes of thought, power and ability were seen especially by those who did not have them as rewards for virtuous behavior in previous lives. The loss, diminution, or absence of power, moreover, revealed to people that a previous existence had been in some way flawed. A person's status in society, therefore, was programmed by someone else's performance in the past, and one's behavior here and now determined where one would stand when one returned to life. To improve personal status, then, one could accumulate merit by performing virtuous acts, like subsidizing a temple or being generous to monks, donating a gilded image of a god, or sponsoring religious festivals. Acts like these were thought to redeem the person performing them. As we shall see, the great temples at Angkor were also thought of as redemptive gestures of this kind, as bargains struck by kings with their immediate ancestors and, through them, with the gods. No one at the time or later could see if the bargains were a success, but the thought of neglecting to make them, especially when the afterlife meant a return to earth, occurred seldom if at all. The notions of patron, client, and entourage become important during later stages of Cambodian history. They are certainly useful keys to 19th century Cambodian society, and to some extent Cambodian political life today, but it would be dangerous to assume that precisely similar arrangements were in effect in Cambodia in the 6th and 7th centuries. We seldom know how overlords came to power, for example, or how they recruited followers. We do not know what made followers linger in their service, or often what the services entailed. The evidence suggests that we can describe pre-Angkorian society in Cambodia as an aggregation of leaders and followers, occupying spaces of territory and spaces in society that were thought about in terms of centers and peripheries, corresponding to the Indian concept of mandalas, although the term itself was not used in a political sense in Cambodia at the time. With a multiplicity of centers, Cambodia was decentralized, segments of what we would call society, i.e., the total of the aggregations, acted independently of each other or were related in sporadic ways. Things were not quite as simple, however. Localized religious cults, like the ones Evelyn Porimaspero and others examined in Cambodia in the 1940s and 1950s, generally stressed the welfare of the community rather than that of the individual, for without communities to perform the work, irrigated rice cannot be grown. Rural life requires alliances. The human sacrifices at Bapanam were one example of this communal orientation. Others included the complex of rituals still ushering in the agricultural year today, the sacred furrow, the towers of sand, and so forth, the royal cults that in effect negotiate with the dead for the welfare of the kingdom, and the boat races that take place in flooded rivers at the end of planting. Although these cults at first appear to be antagonistic to each other, the great and little traditions once again, in fact, they are complementary. Because genealogies were not maintained in Cambodia, except among the elite, the Nak Ta or ancestor people had no family names. They thus became the symbolic ancestors of people in a particular place, or by dying in a place they came to patronize its soil. Nak Ta and inhabited sites could be spoken to and tamed, those in the forest or in abandoned places were thought to be more powerful and more malignant. As a place was inhabited, ancestral traditions over the years gathered around it, although seldom to the same extent as in China or Vietnam. The pre-Angkorian record is almost silent about Nak Ta, but we can assert, by reading back from modern data, that a confrontation between Hindu and local beliefs was less frequent than was a blending of the two. The tendency to syncretize, in fact, was noted by early Chinese visitors. The passage that refers to Shiva's continuous descent onto Mt. Moten, for example, also mentions a bodhisattva, or Buddha to be, that was held in reverence at the time. Occasionally, two Indian gods were blended with each other, as Shiva did with Vishnu to form Harihara, a composite deity much favored by Angkorian kings. By combining the attributes of Shiva, the creator and destroyer of worlds, with those of Vishnu, the preserver, Harihara provided a range of inspiration and displayed an ideal monarch's ability to hold contradictory forces in balance. The process of blending different religions meant that here and there, local spirits received the names of Indian gods, just as localized Greek and Roman deities were renamed in the early years of Christianity. Hindu temples also were often built near sites favored by pre-Indian celebrations. There are Neolithic remains underneath the palace at Angkor. What was being stressed at times like this was the continuity of habitation and a continuity of sacredness ideas in themselves that had deep roots in Cambodian culture. If ancestors became Indian gods in times of centralization and prosperity, the gods became ancestors again when the rationale for Hinduism and its priestly supporters diminished or disappeared. Thus, at Angkor and in Cham sites in Vietnam studied in the 1930s by Paul Muse, Indian images and temples were worshipped in quite recent times not as emanations from India, but as mysterious products of the Nak Ta. This is partly because the literature of the Cham and Cambodian elites, which was used to explain and justify the images and temples, had disappeared or could no longer be deciphered, while the language village people used in their religious lives remained to a large extent unchanged from the pre-Indian era to colonial times. The most enduring cult, as Paul Muse has shown, was the cult of the lingam or stone phallus. This widely diffused motif, and the cults associated with it, exemplified links between ancestor spirits, the soil where they end. The lingam grew, and the fertility of nearby soil for agricultural use. Because of the territorial aspect of the cult, a lingam could be moved from place to place, ceremoniously, but was only potent in one place at a time, and the notion that the lingam was a patron of a community, it was closely supervised by local overlords and by the king in the Angkorian era. As early as the 5th century according to Chinese sources, a cult honoring a mountain god at the hill of Lingaparvata in southern Laos, nowadays known as Wat Phu, involved human sacrifices. The site was notable because it contained an enormous natural lingam, some 18 meters, 59 feet, high. Lingaparvata, like Ba Phnom, was patronized as an ancestral site by several Angkorian kings. The period of Phuanan, then, which lasted until the 6th century, was one in which Cambodia's political center of gravity was located south and east of present-day Phnom Penh. During this period, trade between India and China was intense, and one of the principal components of this trade was Buddhist religious objects. Local religious practices emphasized devotion to Shiva, Vishnu, and the Buddha, as well as to minor and local Hindu deities, particularly female ones, known as Kpan. Politics centered on villages and groups of villages, rather than on a tightly organized kingdom. Irrigated rice allowed for surpluses and for some social differentiation, as Michael Vickery has argued, but not as much as developed later on. The main point to stress about the period, from a historian's point of view, is that we know about it from Chinese sources, which tell about local customs, centralization, and commodities for trade. We hear no Cambodian voices, as we do from the 7th century onward in the form of stone inscriptions. After the waning of Phuanan, in fact, our sources become richer and harder to use. Thanks for listening. You will hear from me again in the next episode. Bye for now and have a good day.